When the Torah was given, it was given to a nation who had been slaves in Egypt. They had mostly worked in Egypt in construction, building cities and walls and bricks, making bricks for Pharaoh. They were now in the desert. However, they were destined to soon enter the land of Israel, where each family would be given a plot of land to farm. The Torah mentions this many times. When they get the land of Israel, every family will be given a plot of land and will live on a farming land, and they will all be able to farm. So therefore, the Torah speaks extensively about farming. It was given to a nation about to become farmers. And while the written Torah speaks quite a bit about farming, the oral Torah, which we've spoken about before, we did a whole class about the oral Torah last year, that is the primary source of our laws. The oral Torah speaks extensively about farming and agricultural related laws. The first major work of the Torah, of the oral Torah, is the Mishnah. We once did a class on the Mishnah. And the Mishnah itself is divided into six starim, or six orders. The first of the six orders is Zra'im, the agricultural laws. So farming rules then are one of six books of the Mishnah, one of six sections of the oral law focused just on agriculture. So farming rules are a significant part of Torah laws. Laws that are mostly not relevant to those who are not farmers in the land of Israel. So Jews lived as farmers by these farming laws of the Torah for many, many generations. Jews remained farmers for most of Jewish history, both in the land of Israel and then even outside the land of Israel. However, over time, we left the farms. We became a mostly urban people. Despite, over history, there's been many, many attempts, we'll soon talk about them, to return Jews back to farming. Hasn't been all that successful. But yet, farming and farming laws remain a significant part of Judaism and Jewish law, the laws of the Torah. They also have an impact, as we'll see, and have meaning, even for us who may not be farmers. One example of laws related to farming that is still relevant for us today is the Torah tells us to celebrate three festivals mentioned all in this week's Parsha, and multiple times the Torah, Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot. The Torah tells us, makes it clear, that Passover celebrates the Exodus. Our oral tradition tells us that Shavuot celebrates the giving of the Torah. And the Torah tells us that Sukkot reminds us how God protected Israel while they traveled through the desert. And yet, the Torah, in Parshat Mishpatim, and then again in Parshat Kitisa, and then again later in Parshat Re'eh, describes each of these festivals in agricultural terms as well. Passover is called Chag Ha'aviv, the festival when the grain ripens. It's at the beginning of the spring, so it's when the grain begins to ripen. Shavuot is called Chag HaKatzir, the harvest festival, marking the beginning of the harvest season. Sukkot is called Chag HaAsif, the festival of gathering the grains before the rainy season begins. They would, in the land of Israel, like California, it does not rain in the summer. So after harvesting the grain, they would bundle the grain and then leave it in the fields to dry out all summer. And then they would, around Sukkot time, they would take all the grain into the silos, storehouses, before the rainy season begins. The rain, of course, will ruin the grain. Right? When it's dry, the drier it is, the easier it is to millet to be able to make flour. So the festivals all therefore mark important farming occasions. In addition to their primary meanings that the Torah also mentions, they're also important farming occasions, and they do have important farming impact. Again, testimony of the role of farming in Jewish history and in Judaism. So we have many, many laws for the farmer in the land of Israel and some laws for the farmer outside the land of Israel. So I'd like to give you just a little bit of a sampling or an overview of the laws, the Torah's laws for farmers in the land of Israel. So the first law, which applies both in the land of Israel and the land of Israel, involves really, the laws are going to involve every aspect of farming from beginning to the end. So the first law really involves when we plow and plant. We are forbidden, the Torah says, from crossbreeding any plants. So we're not allowed to crossbreed plants, try to merge them together into create a new plant. Now, if plants are crossbred, we are permitted to eat them. We are permitted to replant crossbred plants if they can grow. But we are forbidden from actually doing the crossbreeding ourselves between different species. Crossbreeding between plants of the same species, which is most of the horticulture that's done, that is definitely permitted. But crossbreeding between plants of different species is forbidden. We are also forbidden from planting certain plants too close to each other. And there's a complex set of rules as to how close is too close, but we cannot plant plants too close to each other because then they get mixed into each other and impact each other. We're also forbidden from planting fruit trees or edible plants near vines in a vineyard. Now, the rule is that if plants or trees are planted too close to vines in a vineyard, then the plants and the grapes are forbidden to eat. This is only for grapes if it involves vines. So these laws are all part of the prohibitions of kilayim, crossbreeding. I'm not going to get into the details of the kilayim. Maybe one day we can do a class about it, about crossbreeding plants. But there is a prohibition of crossbreeding plants, and we have to be careful not to plant plants too close to each other. Many other laws involve agriculture. On Shabbat, we know we're supposed to rest on Shabbat. What does it mean to rest on Shabbat? So in a class that we did on resting on Shabbat, we learned that there are 39 melachot, or forms of creative work, that we are forbidden from doing on Shabbat. The Mishnah lists all 39. The first 9 of those 39 of them involve farming or the process of creating flour. They are planting, plowing, harvesting, gathering the grain, threshing. Threshing is when the grain grows in stalks. You need to get the kernels, the little seeds, out of the stalks. So you thresh it, you bang it so that the seeds come out. So threshing, winnowing. Winnowing is a process where they separate the chaff and the kernels. And they do that by having a big fan. It used to be a hand-drawn fan. And they would throw, that would be blowing, or bellows that would blow. And they would throw the mixture in the air, and what would happen is the chaff, meaning the stalk, the not the kernels, is very light, so it would blow away, while the kernels themselves fall back down, and that way you separate. We're also forbidden from sorting, because they would sort the kernels from the pieces that were stuck in the kernels. We're forbidden from grinding the grain into flour, and we're forbidden from sifting the flour to be able to get any pieces that fell through the mill out of the flour. So all of these are prohibited on Shabbos. Almost a quarter of the various prohibitions on Shabbat involve farming, involve the process of creating flour. So every Shabbat we must stop from all work, including agricultural work. Now, every 7 years, the Torah tells us, we have a Shemitah, or a sabbatical year. The sabbatical year, we're forbidden, farmers in the land of Israel must stop all agricultural work. They cannot plow, they cannot plant, they cannot harvest, they cannot tend to trees or to plants. They must stop all agricultural work for the seventh year. We did a class about a year and a half ago when we had our last Shemitah, no, sorry, about 2.5 years ago when we had our last Shemitah year. I did a class at the beginning of the Shemitah year about the prohibitions of Shemitah. And that still applies today. Every 7 years in the land of Israel, farmers must stop working the land. But this mitzvah only applies in the land of Israel, the mitzvah of stopping to work the land. There are many further mitzvahs regarding agriculture. In this week's parsha, we mention that the farmers must leave certain things for the poor when they harvest their grain or their fruit. Firstly, they must leave peah. A corner of the field must be left for the poor, and you cannot harvest it. The Torah doesn't say how large that corner should be. Our sages say it should be at least a 60th of the total field. Should be left for the poor, and you can leave as much as you like. Then, when we harvest the field, when we've harvested the grain, any stalks that get left behind as we are gathering the grain, you are not allowed to go back for it. Right? So as you gather the grain, you may lose a few stalks, right, that you leave behind. You've got to leave those for the poor. So too, as you gather your bundles of wheat, so you kind of gather them into bundles, and each bundle is like kind of all around the field. As you gather your bundles of wheat, if you leave a bundle behind, you must leave it for the poor. When harvesting grapes, any unfinished cluster of grapes must be left behind for the poor. So too, all grapes that fall to the ground during the harvest must be left for the poor. So these mitzvot ensure that while we're harvesting our land, we're not only thinking about ourselves and our families, but also always looking out for the poor among us. Today, for farmers, these mitzvot only apply in the land of Israel, but they would apply today for farmers in the land of Israel. They're not so practical, given our modern farming methods. It's not realistic to allow poor people to go harvest grain themselves. They probably won't be able to do much with it. They probably won't know how to harvest it properly without ruining the field. It's not that realistic anymore. Our modern farming techniques don't really leave bundles behind or leave stalks behind. And so the way it's observed today is that farmers in the land of Israel, what they would do is they'll designate a corner for the poor, and then they'll harvest it themselves, and then they'll take a percentage of what they earned, of either their the actual food they got, or it could be of their earnings at the end, and distribute that to the poor instead. Yes?
It's 7 years. So all of the farmers are on the same schedule? It's not staggered?
No, every 7 years, all the land must remain fallow. Every 7 years, our last one was 5782. We're now in the year 5784. So 2 years ago, we had a Shemitah year. We're now in year number 2 of the Shemitah cycle. In another 5 years, there will be, which I guess will be 5789, will be another Shemitah year. The Torah says that if you keep the Shemitah properly, there will be enough grain the year before to last you for the coming year. And so that's what they do. It's a challenge, and today they have funds for farmers in the land of Israel that observe Shemitah. We spoke about it in detail when we did our class. But it's definitely a challenge. You got to rely on God. So another mitzvah for a farmer in the land of Israel is that the Torah says that the first fruit and grain must be given to God. So it's called the bikurim, the first fruit. So if you grow wheat, barley, or any of the other seven species that Israel is blessed with, wheat, barley, grapes, figs, pomegranates, olives, and dates. So if you're growing any of those things in the land of Israel, you must bring the first grain or fruit to the temple. So they would go down to their field as the grain or fruit would ripen. How would they know which are first? So they would go down as they knew it's beginning to ripen, and they would go to all the first fruit and the first grains that are ripening, and they would tie strings around them. Mm-hmm. And that way they would know which one was first. And then later when they would harvest it, they would separate those fruit and those grain that had the strings tied around them. And they would bring them to the temple. First in Shiloh, when there was a temple in Shiloh, and then later to Jerusalem. When bringing them to the temple, the Torah tells us that the farmer must thank Hashem for giving him the land and helping him produce this fruit. And so then he would give the fruit or the grain to the Kohen, who would then eat it with his family in Jerusalem. Today we no longer have a temple, so there is no longer a requirement to bring the first fruit. We no longer have that mitzvah. However, in addition to the gifts to the poor, there are a number of other gifts that we must separate from our produce in the land of Israel. Firstly, once your produce has been harvested and brought into your silos, you must firstly separate between 1/40th and 1/60th of your produce and give it to the Kohen as terumah. It's holy food that the Kohen must eat while they are ritually pure. It is called truma. Then you have to take a tenth of your produce, or tithe, right? A tenth of your produce. And you must give it to the Levite, a descendant of the tribe of Levi, as ma'aser. The Levi then must take from the tenth that you have given him, take 10% of that, and give it to the Kohen as truma. Holy food that the Kohen must eat while he is tahir, while he is ritually pure. And that is called trumat maaser, the truma taken from the maaser. Then, after separating the truma, which was a very small amount, a 40th to a 60th of your produce, giving it to the Kohen, taking another tenth and giving it to the Levi, remember this is already after you separated your first fruit and left the gifts for the poor, then you must take a second 10% and separate it. What do you do with this second 10%? Well, it depends. We know that in the land of Israel, they had this seven-year cycle. The seventh year was the Shemitah cycle, was the Shemitah year. In years 1, 2, 4, and 5 of the seven-year cycle, you would take that second 10% and you would then exchange it for money, for its full value. And then you would take that money with you when you go on the pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And you would use that money, could only be used to buy food in Jerusalem. In years 3 and 6 of the Shemitah cycle, that second tithe would be given to the poor. That's the rules the Torah gives us. This mitzvah of separating truma, the Torah says, should be separated from grain, all grains, from wine, grapes, once we make wine out of it, and oil, olive oil, right? From olives, it's also extensively grown in Israel, still is, and olive oil. Our sages, however, who extended many of the rules of the Torah, extended this rule to apply to all fruits, the original biblical view, law, was for grain, wine, and oil, and only grown in the land of Israel. However, our sages extended this rule to all fruits, vegetables, and grains. So essentially any produce, grown, any human produce that is, grown anywhere in Israel, but they extended it also to what they called Syria. Syria is the area north of Israel. If you think of a map of Israel, Israel is in an area that we call, in French word for it, is the Levant. Levant is the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. So Israel is bordered on the south by a desert, the Sinai Desert. It's bordered on the east by a desert, the Arabian Desert. The north, however, is inhabited, modern-day Syria and Lebanon. So it's hard to define the northern border of Israel. And so therefore, our sages said that extended the laws of Truma and Maaser to all of Syria and Lebanon, going all the way up to the Euphrates River in northern Syria. And so Jews were farmers in Syria during the second and post-second temple period. They would have to separate Truma and Maaser over there as well. Today, the mitzvah of separating Truma and Maaser still applies. So if you are a farmer in the land of Israel, you must separate the truma and maaser. Until you separate the tithes, the fruit may not be eaten. However, there is a bit of a catch over here, and that is that in order to eat the truma, the Kohen needs to be ritually pure. Anyone who came in contact with the dead, the only way to be ritually pure is by being sprinkled with spring water mixed with ashes of a para aduma, a red heifer. We once did a class and we spoke about that in great detail. We don't have that today. So we have no way of becoming tahor, ritually pure. And so therefore everyone is assumed to be impure. Nobody can eat truma. So therefore the way truma is separated today is we just take off a little bit, minuscule amount, because the Torah doesn't give a minimum, and we just and we burn it. Can't do anything with it because you can't eat it, because we're not ritually pure. Then we have to separate the tithes. The first tithe, we said, the first 10%, must be given to a Levi. The problem is that today there are many people whose last names might be Levi or Levi or Levi or Levine or any other Levi related names, right? Segel, anyone know someone named Segel? Very common Jewish name.
Is that Siegel?
Siegel. Siegel is usually, not always, but usually Levi's, because Siegel or Segel in Yiddish and Hebrew is an acronym for Skan Kahuna, a helper to the Kohen. The Levites were helpers to the Kohen. So Siegel is usually Levium. So there are many people whose last names are Levites, and they maybe their fathers told them that they are Levites. However, how do you know that they're really Levites? We have no evidence that anyone is a Levite. So therefore, we can't really give anyone the tithes today. We don't give out the tithes today. But we do have to separate them, and we have to separate the trumas maser, the 10% of the 10% that must be given truma as truma to the Kohen. Now, we cannot give it to the Kohen because nobody's allowed to eat it, because, again, everyone is considered tameh today. So we separate 10% of that, burn it, and then the other 9%, if someone can prove they're a Levi, we'll give it to them. Until then, we hold on to it. And then we take the second tithe. Now, the second tithe we separate, and the second tithe, again, was supposed to be exchanged for money, and then that money brought to Jerusalem to spend on food in Jerusalem. Now, we cannot do that today because that only worked when we had a temple. You can only spend it on food in the place, city where the temple is. There's no temple anymore. So therefore, we do have to separate it. What we do is we separate 10% and we exchange it not for its full value as we're supposed to, but we exchange it only for a minuscule coin. We take a very small silver coin and we exchange it for a silver coin. And then that coin must then be thrown out. So that's how we separate Truma and Maaser. Today, it's usually thrown into the ocean, so that way nobody will ever find it, hopefully. And so that's how we separate Truma and Maaser today. Now, therefore, when buying produce in the land of Israel or from the land of Israel, you've got to be very careful. Produce outside the land of Israel, there isn't much to worry about, right? Because it is usually... Produce in the land of Israel, outside the land of Israel, there isn't much to worry about, unless it was, well, there's one final prohibition, let me just touch on that. There's one other prohibition that was mentioned in last week's parsha, which is when you plant fruit trees, for the first 3 years, we are forbidden from eating the fruit. The fourth year in the land of Israel, you must take the fruit, exchange it for money, and bring the money to Jerusalem and use that money to spend on food in Jerusalem. And then after that, you're allowed to eat the fruit of the tree. Now, the truth is, that law, the first law, not eating the fruit grown on a tree in the first 3 years, applies everywhere in the world. The second law, that the fourth year you must exchange it for money and take the money to Jerusalem to buy food in Jerusalem, that only applies in the land of Israel. However, so today, outside the land of Israel, if you buy fruits or vegetables, So long as they weren't produced in Israel, you don't have much to worry about. Unless the only problem with fruits and vegetables grown outside the land of Israel is that they may have been grown within the first 3 years. Now, the truth is, they may have been produced in the first 3 years of the tree. Now, trees grown from scratch, from a sapling, will not produce fruit within 3 years. No tree will. However, you can take a tree and replant it. If you replant a tree, then it can grow fruit straight away. If it does, it's still forbidden to eat the fruit for the first 3 years. However, given that most trees are not less than 3 years old, when you go to the fruit store, you don't have to worry about it. The only other possible problem would be something that grew in a vineyard with grapes. Also very unlikely, not generally done today. And therefore today, if you go to a fruit store, so long as the fruits and vegetables do not come from the land of Israel, you have nothing to worry about. It's fully kosher. You're allowed to eat it, no problem. You do have one thing that you have to worry about, and we once did a class on, are all fruits and vegetables kosher? So then we discussed this in greater detail. There is one big thing that you have to worry about, and that is bugs. We're not allowed to eat bugs. And fruits and vegetables tend to have, depending on the fruit and the vegetable, tend to have a huge amount of bugs in them. And so those fruits and vegetables that have a tendency to have bugs, particularly leafy vegetables, we must check them. We must check every leaf before eating it to make sure there is no bug on it. Because we're forbidden from eating bugs. But otherwise you can eat fruits and vegetables that were produced outside the land of Israel.
Why are we not allowed to eat books? Not that we want to eat
them. Great question. The Torah forbids us. Doesn't give us a reason.
It doesn't give us a reason.
So, in the land of Israel, though, there are many laws, agricultural laws, that apply. You must make sure that it is not produced in the seventh year, in the Shemitah year. You must make sure that it's not within the first three or even four. The fourth year you can exchange the fruit, but it has to be done for money. And then we exchange it now for a small coin and we get rid of the coin. Again, that can only, that it has to be done properly. While outside the land of Israel, we don't worry about a random fruit that maybe it came from a tree less than 3 years old. In the land of Israel, we do. Furthermore, even if it was produced from a grown tree, or it's maybe something that's a vegetable, that's not a problem, doesn't have a problem of Arla, we still have a prohibition not to eat it unless, and it's not grown in the seventh year, we still have a prohibition not to eat it unless the tithes were separated. The tithes need to be properly separated, the truma and the maser. If the truma and the first maser and the trumat maser and the second maser were not separated properly, then we're not allowed to eat it. So therefore, when buying fruits and vegetables from the land of Israel or in the land of Israel, you have to make sure that there is someone certifying that it is kosher. And indeed, when you go to Israel today, you will see that every single fruit store has a kosher certificate, where someone certifies that all the fruit that this fruit store is selling is under supervision, to make sure that they only buy fruit that all the tithes and everything has been properly, all the truma and the maser and everything has been properly separated, and you are allowed to eat it. So because we have so many additional agricultural laws in the land of Israel, which would make possibly fruit and vegetables and grains forbidden to eat, anything grown in the land of Israel must have additional supervision, kosher supervision, to make sure that all those laws were kept properly. As opposed to outside of Israel, we don't have a problem. In Europe, they import fruits and vegetables, produce from Israel. And so you've got to be aware, if it's usually say which country it comes from. Legally, it does, just like here, it has to say where it comes from. You have to check if it comes from Israel, you're not allowed to eat it unless it has a certification. Here in the United States, we're a little bit far, and we don't really import fruit from that far, fruits and vegetables from that far away. Yes, Susan?
For the first 3 years, were the farmers not supposed to eat the fruit from the trees? What did they do with it?
They'll throw it out.
How do they give it to
the poor?
You're not allowed to give it to anyone. You're not allowed to give it away. You're not allowed to benefit from it.
Can you feed animals?
You cannot feed your animals with it. You can leave it on the tree so that Animals find it and eat it on their own, but you cannot do
so
anything.
So basically, you just leave it alone.
Leave it alone.
For the first 3 years.
Or if you're afraid of rodents, you could take it and toss it.
So maybe that's why there are so few farmers in Israel, because of all this.
Very good question. So for the first 900 years of our history, Jews lived in the land of Israel. When they came to the land of Israel, as we said with Joshua, they were each given, each family was given a plot of land. And Jews remained farmers. For the next 900 years in the land of Israel, Jews continued to farm the land. And while there were some Jews living in towns, and there were definitely towns, most Jews were farmers. The vast, vast majority, it was an agrarian society. After about 900 years in the land of Israel, Jews were then exiled, where the land of Israel was captured by the Babylonians, and the Jews were, almost all of them, were exiled to Babylon. Coming to Babylon, originally they came to Babylon as slaves. However, they quickly earned their freedom, purchased each other's freedom, they quickly became free people, they settled in Babylon, and within a generation, Jews went back to farming. They bought, Babylon was very, very fertile land, much more so than the land of Israel, because it has these great rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, with lots of tributaries in between them, and there were lots of canals back then. Today it's become desert, much of that area, but back then that area was extremely, extremely fertile. And so Jews bought lands all along the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and until within a few generations, most of the lands in Babylon, most of the farmlands, were under Jewish management, under Jewish hands. Jewish Jews owned them. And most Jews owned land. Even those that lived in the towns had farms as well. But most Jews lived on farms, lived in the countryside, lived on farms in Babylon. After 70 years in Babylon, the Persian emperor allowed them to go back to the land of Israel, and they were able to return. And over there, what did they do when they came back to the land of Israel? Most Jews went back to farming. They recultivated the lands that had been left desolate during the years they were gone. Very few people had lived there. And they recultivated the land, and they redeveloped it, and they went back to farming. And throughout the Second Temple period, there were Jews who were farmers in Babylon. In fact, large areas of Babylon were entirely Jewish-owned farms. And most Jews in Israel were farmers as well. Jews at this point also lived in other places, particularly in what today we call Syria and in Egypt. And Jews, possibly in Egypt, but definitely in Syria, were also farmers. Most Jews in Syria had farms too. It was also fertile land. Jews owned farms. That's what Jews did. They were an agrarian people. In the 3rd century, the community in Israel began to dwindle. As Christians grew and the Romans persecuted Jews, the Jewish community in the land of Israel began to dwindle. Until by the 4th century, by the mid-4th century, there were almost no Jews left in the land of Israel. The land of Israel, which had once been a community of millions of Jews, became very, very, very small. There were only a handful. Most of the farms were then left desolate. Men, there were some non-Jewish farmers, Roman, Greek farmers in the land of Israel. Most of the land of Israel by this point was desolate as a result. However, Jews remained farmers in other lands, particularly in Babylon. The community, while the community in Israel was dwindling, the community in Babylon was thriving. And Jews continued to control much of the land, the farming land in Babylon. And most Jews in Babylon were still farmers. And this lasted until the Arab conquest in the 7th century. When the Arabs conquered Babylon and Mesopotamia, and really the entire Persian Empire, slowly, starting in the late 7th century, Jews began to move off the farms and into the cities. So the Arabs in the early 8th century, in the early 700s, established the city of Baghdad, which became one of the largest metropolitan cities in the world. At its height, it was a city of over 1 million people, which back then is huge. If you just think about it, right? They didn't have cars. to get around, right? A city of 1 million people. They weren't building skyscrapers, right? So it was a massive city with a huge Jewish population. Jews lived in various towns and cities around Babylon, but by the mid-8th century, by the mid-700s, most Jews had moved off the farms and were now living in cities. We're not certain why. We don't have good records to tell us why. Was it that the Arabs banned Jews from farming as second-class citizens, banned them from owning farms? Or was it that the opportunities of commerce that the Arab Caliphate offered, because suddenly there was this massive empire that stretched from India to the Atlantic Ocean. And so was this massive, was the commerce, did it beckon Jews away from the farms? It's not clear. Chances are it was a mix of both Arab anti-Jewish laws and Jews being drawn to more opportunities. But regardless, as a result, by the 750s or so, 800, most Jews in Babylon were no longer farmers. Many Jews took the opportunities of the new lands captured by the Arabs, conquered by Arabs, and moved to them, moving back to Israel, back to Syria, which had been part of the Roman Empire and had dwindled. There was a community there, but had gotten smaller, moving to Egypt, moving to Tunisia, which was a great Arab center, moving to Morocco, to Al-Andalus, which was modern-day Spain, which was then Moorish Spain, Arabic. We also had a class on the Jews of Spain. But Jews in all these places were mostly urban. They lived in cities. They were traders. They were craftsmen. They were professionals. They did not go back to the farms. And this really remained. From the mid-700s, when Jews left the farms, possibly forced out, possibly willingly, in Babylon. That's where, again, most Jews in the world lived in Babylon at the time. Most Jews were farmers. So most Jews, many Jews were farmers at this time, but within a century of the Arab conquest, Jews left the farms and very few Jews were farmers. It does seem there were still Jewish farmers in Babylon, even in later centuries. Jews went into farming in other places. We have records of Jews being farmers in Spain, in North Africa, in other places, Jews were farmers as well, but it was not common. Most Jews remained urban. In many, many Christian lands, Jews were, and same in many Muslim lands, Jews were unable to own land. They were not allowed to own land outside of the cities, that is. They could only own their own houses, but they could not own land, farming land. It was banned for Jews to own. And so as a result, Jews were not working the farms. Jews did not have their own farms, nor did they ever become serfs working for others on the farms. They preferred to be independent and work as craftsmen, or work as independent businessmen, traders. And that remained even as Jews traveled throughout the diaspora in various different places across Europe, the Middle East, North Africa was primarily where Jews lived. They remained off the farm. Mostly. There were exceptions. There were definitely Jews who were farmers. Starting in the 19th century, there was a strong movement for Jews to move back to the farms, for Jews to become back farmers once again. This really began the early 19th century in the Russian Empire. The Russian Empire at the time had a very, very large Jewish community, the largest Jewish community in the world by far. One day we could do the Jews of the Russian Empire. We could do a class on that. But the Jews lived in the Russian Empire under terrible conditions. They were limited to what was called the Pale of Settlement. In other words, there was a certain regions that they were allowed to live in and nowhere else in the vast empire. And they were also, in much of the Russian Empire, they were banned from farming. They had been banned previously. Even before that area came under Russian control, they had been banned from owning land. And now they were further, only aristocrats in Poland were allowed to own land. And so they were in the Russian Empire. Jews were further banned from owning land. So they really could not farm. However, there was a problem. There were lots of Jews. They were very, very poor. They were limited to what they could do. They were limited in their trades. And In the early 19th century, the Russian Empire conquered vast lands from what had been the Ottoman Empire. And in the south, these lands were called Novorussia. Novorussia was modern-day southern Ukraine. So modern-day southern Ukraine and Moldova, where a lot of the fighting is going on today that you're hearing about, that was part of the Ottoman Empire until the early 19th century. We spoke about this when we did our class on the Jews of Ukraine. And then when the Russians captured it, it was called Novorussia. Now, when the Russians captured it, the inhabitants of southern Ukraine and Crimea at the time were Tartars. Tartars are a Turkic people that are Muslim Turkic people. They were the inhabitants at the time, but there were not a lot of them. It was not densely inhabited. But the Russian Empire wanted to develop that area. It was excellent farmland. It's among the best farmland in the world still today. And it also they wanted to be able to develop it, make it part of Russia. And so therefore, they essentially created like a homestead act, where anyone who wants can go and move there, and they get plots of land and get land to farm. And in order to encourage, because Russians weren't that keen on going, they even allowed Jews from the Pale settlement to settle anywhere they wanted in Novorussia, in southern Russia, southern Ukraine, and Crimea. And they encouraged them, any Jew who settled anywhere would get a plot of land to farm. Wherever you go, you could just, as long as you develop that land, it will become yours. And so many Jewish leaders at the time strongly encouraged young Jews who really had no means of supporting themselves, because unless you become another tailor or another cobbler, where each town had so many already, what would you do, right? Yeah, I mean, or another merchant, but there were tons of peddlers. There were too many of each profession that Jews were allowed to do. So many, many young, so many Jewish communities, many Jewish leaders helped raise money. Many wealthy Jews helped fund this to build Jewish settlements in southern Ukraine. And so as a result, dozens and dozens of Jewish settlements and tens were built. Tens of thousands of Jews moved all across southern Ukraine, Moldova, Crimea, and built out these Jewish settlements, Jewish farming towns all across southern Ukraine. And many of these towns, they're in the news because they've been fighting in these various towns around the city of Kherson and around the city of Nikolaev and Dnipro. These are the larger cities. In southern Ukraine, and around these cities, Kishinev, there were many, many Jewish farming settlements that were built in these areas, and many Jews turned to farming. Later in the 19th century, Jews in the Russian Empire continued to suffer, and many Jews wanted to leave. They wanted opportunities to go elsewhere. And some tried moving to the United States, many to other countries. So at the time, there was a very, very wealthy Jew, probably the wealthiest Jew in the world at the time, was an Austrian Jew called Baron Hirsch. And Baron Hirsch developed a Jewish farming collective where the goal was to help Jews establish farms. And they purchased lands in Argentina, and they helped tens of thousands of Russian Jews move to Argentina and move onto farms. Here in the United States, they did the same thing. They built farms here in the United States with the help especially of HIAS, the Hebrew Immigration Society, that was very worried that there were way too many Jews in New York. But as Jews moved, most of them ended up in New York or some other large cities, and they were living in slums in these large cities. They were very, very poor when they came. They were living in these tenement houses. They were working in these factories, very, very hard work. Life was very, very difficult for the Jews. And so what they did was they tried to encourage them to go to farms. And they developed farming communities. And there are still many farming communities across the country that started as Jewish communities. Then, well, at the same time, late 19th century, there was an organization called Chovevei Tzion, Lovers of Zion, who decided that Jews belonged in the land of Israel. But the only way for Jews to move back to the land of Israel, Israel was undeveloped at the time, would be to build farms, to develop the land, and cultivate the land, and build farms. And they started, eventually, they became the Zionist movement, and they started building farms in the land of Israel as well, supported by the Rothschilds and by others who helped them develop these farms in the land of Israel. Now, so there were many, the 19th century is a story really of Jewish farms. However, for whatever reason, those farms never really panned out too well. Jews, once they tasted urban lifestyle, never seemed to really like going back to the farms. So although they were Jewish farmers, even in the Jewish settlements that they made in southern Ukraine, which was somewhat successful, within two, three generations, many of those Jews were leaving and going to Odessa, going to the big cities, they wanted to be in the big cities. They didn't want to be in the small towns. They didn't want to be farmers. And so over time, more and more Jews moved out of the farms. Here in Argentina, the same thing happened. In the United States, the same thing happened. Over time, more and more Jews moved away from the farms. Until, really, they were bought by corporations, or non-Jews moved in, until there really were no Jews left on the farms. They didn't like staying on the farms. The land of Israel, some of those farms are still there today, but most Jews in Israel are not farmers anymore, have moved to other pursuits. For whatever reason, Jews have never kept to farming long term since we left the farms about 1,300 years ago. And despite all these attempts for Jews to move to farmings, to farm, there are still thousands of Jewish farmers today in the United States, mostly in the United States and Israel, but also in some other countries. But there are, relative to the number of Jews in the world, there are very, very few Jewish farmers.
There are a lot of farmers in Israel that I visited. They're kibbutz.
There are a lot of kibbutz farmers. There are a lot of yeshuvim that are farms. But a lot is relative. There are a few dozen we're talking about, right? Maybe, you know, a couple thousand, the low tens of thousands of people are farmers in Israel, you know, out of a population of close to 10 billion.
Everything grows on the kibbutz, or I was on the kibbutz, so we had oranges and bananas and everything.
Right, a lot of them, some of them are farmers, that's their primary income. A lot of them have other jobs and other businesses, exactly. And farming is just kind of a hobby, just a side thing. So, why is Judaism, but yet, although we have not gone back to the farms really for the last 1,300 years, as hard as we've tried, but why is farming so central to Judaism? So the Jerusalem Talmud in the Book of Shabbos tells us that a farmer is mamin b'chaye olam v'zoria, believes in God and plants. In other words, farming requires an immense amount of faith. Anything can happen. You plant. There could be no rain this year. There could be a drought. There could be floods. There could be viruses, diseases, right, that hit the farms, right? There could be all sorts of things that can happen that can ruin the farm, that can ruin your plant. You plant and you got to leave the rest up to God. There's only so much that you can do. We cannot control the harvest. Even today with all of our modern technology, we still cannot control the harvest, right? And we still have times, years, that there are bad harvests. Just this year, there's been, you've probably all heard, if you use olive oil in your cooking, that there's been a bad olive oil harvest this year, and today olive oil has become ridiculously expensive, two, three times what it usually costs. So we're still very susceptible to the farming, nature of farming. And that's because a farmer has a unique relationship with Hashem. A farmer must farm and rely on Hashem that he will take care of it. And even though we are not farmers today, we still have the role of farmers in two ways. Firstly, a farmer takes a seed and produces fruit, produces grains. Take something very small and they produce. Our role is to become productive. We have to produce. We have to create things. But also, we have to remember that we could do our part, we could work hard, but ultimately it's up to Hashem. There are many, many people who work very hard in life and don't succeed. Sometimes people blame, say you weren't successful because you didn't work hard enough. There's many people who work very hard and don't succeed. And it's not because they're not smart. They're often very smart and they don't succeed. Evidenced by the fact that most people that are successful are only successful for a very short period of their lives. They're successful for part of their lives, but earlier parts of their lives, later parts of their lives, they're not successful. Why? Does it mean that they're less smart than they were during their successful years? Or are they working less hard? No. It's all up to Hashem. So it's important to remember, we learned this from the farmer, that you plant, you do your part, and then Hashem does the rest. Don't think that you are responsible for your own successes or failures. Ultimately, it is Hashem who is responsible. And that is the lesson that we learned for farming. That is why farming is so central to Judaism.